This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
It was the shot heard around the world. At 6:11 p.m. last Saturday, Donald Trump just turned his head ever so slightly to look at a graph up on the screen, causing the shooter's bullet to just clip his ear instead of ending his life. What does that event mean for you? What does that mean for the world? Let's get into that on today's Trumpet Hour. Usually we focus on international news on this show. The Trumpet Daily Show, hosted by Mr. Stephen Flurry, goes out every single day and tends to be quite focused on what is happening within the United States. So we err on the side of covering everything else, showing you all the other important events going on all around the world for the last week. This week, the news out of the United States is just too big and too relevant for what this show is all about, for us to leave out and for us even to just not kick off straight with that. And there are so many dramatic stories out from the United States this week. We could be seeing the end of Joe Biden's presidency and certainly his presidential run, perhaps as soon as this weekend. We've had the Republican National Convention. We've had Donald Trump officially nominated as the Republican candidate. We've seen his vice presidential pick. But the biggest news of all is that assassination attempt from last week. And so many see that that was a miracle. I mean, these are some headlines from some conservative news outlets. Jesus Christ is Donald Trump's security detail. That was from The Federalist. God's hand on Donald Trump. That's PJ Media. Former snipers agree it's a miracle Trump is still alive. That was from Zero Hedge. And it's not hard to see that that was a miracle, that that was divine intervention. But do you see the opportunity and the obligation that that presents you? If that was a miracle, well, then that means that God is directly involved in world affairs. There have been a lot of political assassinations in history. Just a couple of years ago, the former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was shot. Why did God intervene in this one? Why didn't he intervene in many of these others? How does God decide when to get involved and when not to? Why has God even allowed America to get to the point where the country is this divided and where you have this kind of hatred, where you have this kind of shooting, and then you have all of these questions afterwards about how did the Secret Service even allow this? Does God have some kind of master plan behind something like this, where he steps in and saves an individual's life? In Daniel 4 and verse 17, God says that he wants all those living to know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will and sets up over it the basest of men. And God decides who survives assassination attempts, who rules. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry called that the greatest lesson mankind could possibly learn. He writes, God has given mankind 6,000 years to rule his own way, but he still makes certain that all events are shaped by his master plan. And that really is the core purpose of this show, to show that all events are shaped by God's master plan, by the gospel. And we saw that so clearly with this attempted assassination last Saturday. But it's there in everything else that we talk about. It's there in military deals in Asia, in political chaos in Europe, in Israel's stubborn resistance to terrorism. All of these events, and a lot more, give us powerful proof that God rules in the kingdom of men, are opportunities for us to learn the most important lesson that mankind could possibly learn. So if you recognized that God saved Donald Trump this week on Saturday, what are you going to do about it? There is a living God. He has a plan for the world. He tells us his plan in his Bible. Well, surely then that makes digging into the Bible, understanding his plan for the world, his plan for you, bringing your life into harmony with that plan, with what God wants done. Well, that's got to be one of the most important things that you can be doing right now. So let's look at all of the events from this last week through the lens of God's plan, starting with the dramatic news from America. So here to help us do that is my colleague who watches the United States of America, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You're absolutely right. This is nothing short of miraculous. I'm sure most of our listeners have already seen the video footage. I'm pretty sure there's very few people on Earth who haven't seen the video footage. I've seen news clips this week of like young children from Central African nations reenacting this narrow escape. I've even seen cartoons from Japan showing the spirit of America, I guess it was, plucking the bullet out of the air. So this is a nation that's not even Christian. They might not say Jesus Christ is Donald Trump's security detail like an American evangelical would, but they still realize that there is Donald Trump has some sort of guardian angel that protected him from this, because by all accounts, he should be dead. His head was in the crosshairs. A sniper had him in his sights from only 400 feet away. Any former snipers, you mentioned some of the former snipers saying that like, that's a really easy shot for anyone with any gun training. He's like, basically in basic training, if you can't make that shot from 400 feet, like you don't even pass. The only explanation for this is divine intervention. We've already gotten into the scripture a bit already. The scripture I wanted to highlight today was in Amos chapter 7, particularly verses 1 through 8. But in verses 8, where God says, I won't pass by anymore. If you read our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald, for his book, America Under Attack, which I recommend everyone do, he talks about those first 8 verses talking about America being under attack and God passing by 3 times. And the 3rd time is the last time. And he explains that those first 2 times he passed by were during the Barack Obama administration. So this is the last time God's going to pass by and use this political figure, save him through divine intervention, to save the nation so the Americans even have a chance to repent of the sins that have allowed all this dramatic curses on America to occur in the first place. And there's some pretty dramatic curses, which if you just step back for a minute and think about, like, well, we've seen the Russia collusion gate scandal, we've seen the impeachment scandals, we've seen all this lawfare and other attempts to destroy Donald Trump, which have kind of crescendoed in this attempt to blot out his life. And the fact that a sniper was able to get within 400 feet of the president is very disturbing. In the past, maybe you've had some more fringe characters like Alex Jones talk about the deep state's going to try to assassinate Donald Trump. But this week, we've got Sean Davis, who's the CEO and co-founder of The Federalist. A very respectable newspaper, saying that this doesn't make sense unless he had help on the inside. Dinesh D'Souza, well-published author. He's spoken in Armstrong Auditorium. He's been on the Trumpet Daily radio program. He's made a lot of money selling a lot of books. Also said on his podcast this week, it's like, this does not make sense unless this shooter had help on the inside. I saw a headline this morning that they said the shooter, the gun he used, he hid on the premises beforehand. That way he didn't have to carry the gun. So the gun was already hidden on the premises. He came up, he walked up this building 400 feet away, really nice flat surface, only a 4.76% slope. There was no attempt to obstruct the view from Donald Trump. And pretty much any security analyst has looked at this and said, like anyone, like a middle schooler who looked at this site would identify that roof as the number one vulnerability at the speaking site. And yet the Secret Service deliberately made the call to exclude the roof from their security zone, put it under the jurisdiction of local police, and then have the local police not put anyone on the roof. There were 4 counter snipers on that site. 2 of them were on the roofs behind Donald Trump. They were employed by the Secret Service, and they're the guys who end up killing the assassin. The other two counter snipers, mind-bogglingly, were inside the building the shooter was on. I don't know much about being a sniper, but I get the impression that your skill on taking long-range shots is wasted if you're inside a building.
You make a couple of very important points. I think this overview that there are some things going very wrong in America right now, and in Britain, and in many of these other countries, that God is allowing a lot of terrible curses. If we don't repent, those curses are going to get a whole lot worse. But the overview from Amos 7 is that God has a reprieve. He's involved in world events. He uses Donald Trump to give a temporary breathing space from some of those curses, to allow a message to go out one last time and give people an opportunity to repent. Okay, you've experienced some of the curses. It's going to get worse. We'll take them away for a little bit. You have a chance now. Are you going to use it? Are you going to turn to God? And the fact then that we're in this situation where something incredibly dodgy seems to be happening within the US Secret Service, where it's like the best defense for the Secret Service is, oh, actually, we're just really, really incompetent, which is not a particularly credible or particularly comforting defense. We've also got Jeremiah Jacques joining us, who's our Asia correspondent. Maybe I could put you on the spot just a moment, Jeremiah, because you actually were at a Barack Obama rally, I think you were telling us earlier in the week, and had your own encounter with the Secret Service, if I remember correctly.
That's right, yes. This was in 2013 after a big tornado had demolished a lot of Moore, Oklahoma. And that's pretty close to our studio here in Edmond. So a few of us drove down there, including Sam Livingston, who many of you may know from the Trumpet Daily Show. And we actually climbed up a tree at one point to get a better look at President Obama. He had traveled down to the scene of devastation just to speak about what he planned to do to try to help the community there rebuild. And so we climbed a tree, must have been, I would estimate 500 or 600 yards away. But a couple of Secret Service agents came over to us very quickly. And they said, guys, get down. We're the Secret Service. Of course, we can see that you're not armed with anything except for cameras. But even still, the Secret Service gets very, very nervous when we see people up high, up in a tree, or up in a location like that, when the President of the United States is a short distance away. So we said, we understand, and we climbed down, and that was the end of it. But it showed that they were, you know, very vigilant. And I think that that's the sort of vigilance that you would expect from the Secret Service, what we experienced there.
Yeah, I think it does highlight that if they're watching trees 500 yards away, how unusual it is for them to not be watching a building 140 yards away. And I think that we've certainly had a lot of even more disturbing news as the week has rolled out on what's going on there. And I wonder how long it's going to take us to get the full truth on what is happening. But Andrew, also, I guess another upshot of this, I don't want to discount more shenanigans to upset the election. You know, the people opposed to Donald Trump are not people that are going to bow out easily. But certainly the view from, say, the United Kingdom looking at this is kind of like, well, the US race is over now. This is Donald Trump's. He's won the election. Now, like I said, I don't think those in power are going to just quietly walk away. But is that the mood you'd say in the United States as well, that this is just the shooting, the way he behaved in the aftermath of the shooting that really was just very presidential? I think he had a speech at the Republican National Convention. Do people kind of look at that election now as a shoo-in?
I think so. You hinted at this at the beginning of the program, but the Washington Post reported this week that both Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi, two of the most powerful people in the Democratic Party, have now officially advised Joe Biden to reconsider his presidential run, which means that, like, all the way up to the top, people are admitting, even Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, CNN, that Joe Biden cannot defeat this pro-Trump wave that's taken America. And so now you're scrambling for a new candidate. Van Jones, he made big news in America years ago when Glenn Beck, he was a Barack Obama, one of his climate change czars. Glenn Beck exposed him as a communist, like he actually voted for the Communist Party at one point. He now works for CNN. And so he's, as a communist, he's very liberal and he's very anti-Trump. But he said this week that the excitement at the RNC over Donald Trump reminds him of the excitement that gripped America in 2008 during Barack Obama's first term, the hope and change run. And so these are some very liberal analysts on 2008, like saying that they not only think Donald Trump's going to win, but they think he may win in as big a victory as America has not seen since Obama ran in 2008. That's very concerning for them because, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be ballot stuffing. I'm sure there's going to be ballot mules. Mike Lindell will have plenty to talk about abnormalities in the Dominion voting systems and other ways to steal the election. But the last election, Peter Navarro, who just got out of prison this week, they let him out of prison just in time for the RNC. So he's pretty happy about that. He published a three-part report saying that he estimates that the Democrats stole the election with maybe 300,000 fraudulent votes put in strategic swing counties. If the excitement at the RNC is any indication, you are going to need a whole lot more than 300,000 stolen votes to steal this election. You are going to need such a vast army of ballot mules going around boxes at 3 a.m. stuffing fraudulent ballots in elections that it would be obvious to a blind mole rat that this election was stolen. So I think it's that's what they're concerned about. Is like that is the mood. Is like Trump's going to win, and he's going to win by so big a margin that even if there is an election fraud, it's not going to be near enough.
Which means I think we could be set for some pretty dramatic results coming up. There's been a lot of illegal things that have been done under really the Barack Obama third term. And you know, these aren't people that can even afford to quietly walk away, which does make you wonder if ballot stuffing isn't enough. What else is going to happen? And that's something, you know, this is the cover we've been talking about quite a lot this week, where we had a cover of the Trumpet print edition with a picture of Donald Trump with Ready for War emblazoned on it. And that article really talks about, again, how these same prophecies that say, well, yeah, God's going to provide a reprieve from some of these attacks under President Trump and an opportunity for America to repent. It also says that he's going to have to war for that opportunity. There'll be some form of figurative, maybe even literal warfare involved, and we could see that. Well, I think we skipped straight to your main story. Were there any other stories that you wanted to bring to our attention this week, Andrew, from the United States, or anything that I've got from what we were talking about earlier?
Well, yeah, the Trump assassination is definitely the biggest story, and probably second unto it is just the excitement at the RNC, which I've already covered. We've already talked about the fact that Joe Biden, who just 2 weeks ago was saying the only way he would bow out of the race is if God himself came down and told him to, he's now amended that to say that he'd bow out of the race if God told him to, or if his team said there was no way he could win, or if his doctors say he wasn't fit for office. And now it looks like there's a pretty good chance all three of those things are going to happen. So there's a good chance he's leaving. Probably the only other big story I'd mention in America this week, which in another week where all those other things didn't happen would have been my top story, is the fact that the justice in the 11th Circuit Court, who was overseeing Jack Smith's prosecution against President Trump for handling classified documents, has thrown that out of court. And she didn't. Now, Trump was trying to make the case that as a former president, he had the right to handle classified documents. And he's probably right about that. The judge didn't even rule on that question. The judge threw it out of court because they said Jack Smith isn't even a real prosecutor because he wasn't appointed by the Senate. Attorney General Garland just appointed him as a special prosecutor to prosecute Trump, which is something that Americans have been doing for over 100 years. It's a longstanding practice to appoint someone from outside the federal government to look into cases like these. But the judge, based on a concurring opinion that Justice Thomas had written, said that, like, actually, no, the Constitution's very clear that federal officers have to be appointed by the executive and confirmed by the Senate. Therefore, since Jack Smith wasn't confirmed by the Senate, him and all other federal prosecutors are, by their very constitutional nature, illegitimate, which basically throws out not just the classified documents case, but also the January 6th case. All these 91 crimes Trump's been convicted of, I guess they already convicted of him of the falsifying business records, but pretty much all the other crimes he's been convicted of, or most of them, are no longer even be considered until the Supreme Courts decide, is Jack Smith even a real prosecutor, or is he just some guy who made some accusations against the president without any congressional authority? So that legally, that's a really big change and highlights another prophecy that we've brought up in here in also in Amos 7. It's, I forget which verse, but it's a little after verse 8 about the king's chapel and the king's court helping Donald Trump, this end time Jeroboam, come back to power. And it's now very clear that the Democrats, they tried to ban Donald Trump from the ballot. They tried to put him in jail for 91 crimes. The Supreme Court pretty much struck all that down and just opened the road for Donald Trump to come back to power. They actually haven't ruled that the last election was illegitimate or anything, but they've opened the road for him to run again. And now it's kind of up to the King's Chapel, which is mostly composed of all these religious people who are now talking about how Jesus Christ is Donald Trump's security detail to get him over the finish line.
Well, thank you for that overview. It really is remarkable that I'm sitting here, you started to talk about that, and then I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about the Judge Cannon story, which, as you say, is any other week would have been just a massive story. And I think it's a sign of how big a lot of these stories coming from the United States are, that for Europe, even the main thing I wanted to talk about is just the upshot, the ramification of these events from America, where as part of the Republican National Convention, as part of everything else going on this week, we've gotten a look at Donald Trump's vice presidential pick. And in this combination of Europe now looking at this and thinking, okay, Donald Trump is very likely to be the next president, and this is the guy that he's picked as his vice president, that's really gotten a lot of attention in Europe. So this vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance, James David Vance, he wrote an article in February for the Financial Times that has really gotten a lot of attention right now. And he wrote, Europe must stand on its own two feet on defense. That was the title of that. He said regarding Ukraine, he said, there's frankly no good reason that aid from the United States should be needed. He singled out Germany. He said, Germany is the most important economy in Europe, but it relies on imported energy and borrowed military strength. U.S. leaders across the spectrum support Europe and see the value of generation-old alliances, but as we watch European power atrophy under an American protectorate, it is reasonable to ask whether our support has made it easier for Europe to ignore its own security. He says, defense spending and defense readiness are two different things. For example, Germany spends considerably more than France on defense each year, for little to show for it. So he is very keen on encouraging much greater European military spending and cutting American military support for Europe in order to do that. And this is another critical prophesied trend. I think it's very easy to sympathize with that case from J.D. Vance, and ultimately that's Donald Trump's view as well. I think a lot in Europe hate to admit it, but they have benefited enormously from American military defense over the years. And I mean, it was American nuclear weapons loaned to European nations that stopped the Soviets from steamrolling across Western Europe. It was the very real, tangible threat of a nuclear retaliation that kept Soviet troops out of West Berlin, out of West Germany, probably even out of France and beyond. So these countries do have a tremendous debt to the United States in that regard. And then because they haven't had to foot the bill for their own defense, they've been able to develop all of these economies, these social welfare systems. So basically you're in the situation now where American defense spending subsidizes lavish benefits in Europe that American citizens aren't able to have at home. So yeah, I think it's very easy to sympathize with American politicians that say, well, we need to make Europe pay its fair share. But we also need to point out what is prophesied. And that is, we mentioned that the dark times are coming, that God is giving America a reprieve, and then there are worse curses to come. Those curses are prophesied to be inflicted by a European military giant. And that's described in Revelation 13, for example. It describes this empire that rises and falls. It gives a description that matches the Roman Empire. And we see in Europe, there have been various different leaders that have tried to resurrect that Roman Empire. And it's fallen, and they've tried to resurrect it again. And in Revelation 13, it says, well, the world looks at this, and it's this modern resurrection of the European power, and it's an incredible war-making machine. They say, well, who is likened to this beast power? Who is able to make war with him? And so while what Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and many of these others are doing, I think, is 100% understandable, it's pushing Europe to become this military power. And America coming along and saying, well, no, we're not going to protect you. We're not going to pay this cost. At a time then that Russia is steamrolling, well, they would like to be steamrolling across Ukraine. They're not. But at the time where Russia is growing in military power, where there is radical Islam in the Middle East, where there are very real threats, that's going to cause some big changes within Europe. And I think we see that with this presidential pick. But I think they're not the only ones. Europe is not the only part of the world to be kind of having this reaction to this week's news. I think both Asia and the Middle East have been having that response. I'm also joined here by Simon Zekic, our Middle Eastern correspondent. Maybe we could just all four of us have a bit of discussion about some of these events and how it's impacting these different regions.
Of course. Now, as you mentioned, there are plenty of countries, not just in Europe, that are a little bit nervous with the elections coming in the States and the results of them. Almost everybody's certain Donald Trump is going to win. In Iran, they recently had their presidential elections. We talked about that recently. Between the six candidates that are running for the Iranian presidency, basically the one big topic that kept surfacing over and over again in debates and advertisements and that kind of thing is who's the strongest leader to face down Trump. In a sense, it's actually the opposite reaction to what you were talking about. The Middle East obviously has been very important for a while to the United States. It seems a week doesn't pass without really explosive events capturing the attention of the world, or even just happening so common we forget that active wars are happening there. And Iran, when Trump was first in office, was one of his big targets on how to pacify everything. And that probably had a good deal on why the Ayatollah chose a so-called moderate to fill the presidency in Tehran. But going into Israel, they're actually excited for all of this for very good reason. And if you go back to the RNC, which you talked about, J.D. Vance, he's very much against the U.S. taking all the or paying all of the defense budgets for Europe. But when it comes to Israel, he actually said that, you know, they're our ally, we need to support them. And in the Republican National Convention, when people started talking about foreign affairs and people start giving their inspirational speeches, the country that was referenced or made prominent by far is Israel, not Ukraine, not Taiwan, Israel. In fact, they even had the parents of one of the hostages, who was a dual American citizen, come and speak before everybody, and they flat out said, Trump says we stand with the American hostages. There's obviously a lot more
people. Well, they prayed for the return of the American hostages, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm. And there's obviously a lot more than just Americans over there. But you would think with dual citizens being in Gaza right now, if it was any other country in the world that abducted American citizens, they probably would have been freed by now. And I think a lot of people in Republican circles and in the public at large know that, which is why everybody, well, it supports Israel, but also why Israel is really, really excited for what's coming.
I can jump in here with a little bit about Asia. It's somewhat similar, I think, to the situation in the Middle East. It's a bit of a mixed bag, you know, the reaction to the Trump-Vance ticket. Donald Trump has many views that lean toward isolationism. On the whole, he seems doubtful about the benefits of America exercising global leadership. And so the Russians and the Chinese have been eager, I think, to see him return to office. Trump has said that he does not plan to reverse Russia's invasion of its neighbors. At one point, he said America should let Russia do whatever it wants, even to NATO countries, if those countries don't build stronger militaries. Just last night during the convention, he reiterated that. So, you know, he's also implied earlier this week that America probably shouldn't help Taiwan if it's invaded by China. Maybe that's not exactly what he meant, but that's the way his statement was taken. And that, of course, was just music in the ears of Xi Jinping. And because of Trump's statements along these lines, many people in the U.S. and around the world were hoping that he would choose as his running mate somebody that would maybe balance that out and give reassurance to America's international partners that the U.S. still supports democracy across the globe in places like Taiwan and is still committed to its NATO allies and other allies. But that did not happen. Trump chose J.D. Vance instead, and Vance seems to have those same sentiments as Trump, as you guys have mentioned, but probably even to a greater degree. He is driven by a belief in scarcity, American scarcity. He thinks American resources are scarce in the context of foreign policy, and that we shouldn't be involved very much outside of our borders, with the notable exception of Israel, as Mahilo pointed out there. But in Moscow and in Beijing, there's been quite a lot of excitement about the Trump-Vance ticket, especially in Moscow, where the propagandists are celebrating, literally celebrating. So that's pretty much the situation with Russia and China. But with other nations like Japan and South Korea, they have quite a different view of all this. These are democratic nations that are formal treaty allies to America, and they love being under America's nuclear umbrella, you know, just as protection from Russia and China. They love having a defense alliance with the U.S. But during Trump's first term, he often questioned the value of those alliances. And he called into question America's commitment to helping Japan and South Korea. So because of that, many in these nations are nervous about another Trump term and feeling quite a lot of insecurity right now. But all of that being said, though, Trump often speaks in kind of a hyperbolic way. Sometimes I think that's a bit of a negotiation tactic for him. So it may well be that he's still committed to stopping aggressor nations and still committed to helping various allies. And it may be that he does not plan to let Vance end U.S. support to various partner nations. He's never been fully predictable with a lot of these kinds of things. And I think that that can work to his advantage. So really, I think we just need to wait and see how it all shakes out.
Yeah, I agree on the wait and see part. I mean, at the end of the day, Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine while Joe Biden was in power, not while Donald Trump was in power. And I think there's some pretty strong reasons for that. So I do think waiting and seeing is important. I think there are other prophecies that potentially tie in as well. I mean, J.D. Vance making the point that American resources are scarce. I mean, the Bible does talk about America spending a lot of its strength in vain. And really, it has been doing a lot of that, spending its strength in ways that have been wasted. So bringing some prudence to American foreign policy and understanding that America's attention, America's resources, America's willpower is not infinite. Maybe there could be some temporary improvements there. But certainly, I think what we've seen on the ticket has been something that has gained a lot of attention. And we do know the basic overview is going to see Europe becoming more militaristic and more powerful. But also, we're going to see Asia rise, become more militaristic and more powerful, and form their own military alliances, as in the long run, America's military impact on the rest of the world decreases. Well, I did also, that was my main story from Europe, really, was how Europe was responding to this vice presidential pick. I did have a few quick stories that are worth mentioning. The European Commission president was selected this week, and it is going to be, once again, Ursula von der Leyen, the former German defense minister. It was a little bit unknown. The European Parliament have a procedure that I think is pretty ridiculous when it comes to voting on people in office, where it's voted on via secret ballot. So secret ballots make sense if you're a voter. You know, if you're going to go, if somebody's going out and they're voting for making their presidential pick, You don't want that individual to be able to be bullied or to have their landlord dictate to them who they vote. You want their vote to be secret. But if it's your elected official, if they're sitting in a Congress or Parliament, you want to know how they voted. So if they voted in a way that you disagree with, you can boot them out of office. The European Parliament does things like this by secret ballot, though, which, I guess, it makes no sense in a democracy. I think really it's just another way of making this European Parliament the illusion of democracy rather than its reality. It makes it much easier for things to be stitched up in backroom deals rather than things being fully open and accountable. But it also meant that going into this vote, there was a fair degree of uncertainty. People weren't sure if a political party may have said, okay, yeah, we're going to throw our support behind Ursula von der Leyen. There was no way of knowing whether the particular MPs would follow through on that. She did, in fact, she got quite a bit more than the bare minimum of votes. She's now beginning to assemble a new European Commission. And we're seeing Germany retain its high influence within Europe. The fact that these top jobs are given to Germans is a powerful symbol, really, that they're the ones dominating and controlling the European Union. And a lot of her talk was on right around what we talked about with America's response to the return of Donald Trump, where a lot of her talk was about a defense union, armaments, military. That's what she wants to make a real priority over the next 4 or 5 years, Europe working together to become a serious military power. So we're seeing Europe rise in that way. And then I wanted to cover a story here from the United Kingdom. This is from last night, where we had some massive civil unrest. You had violent mobs running out of control in an area in the city of Leeds. They overturned a police car. I think they torched a bus. Riot police ran away. They chased the riot police out of the neighborhood, and the riot police just stayed out all night, stayed away. Give people room to destroy, I guess you could say, from the United States' experience. The local councillor, Mothin Ali, was elected on basically a pro-Hamas ticket. I think that tells you everything you need to know about the makeup of those that live in this particular area. Mainstream media does not want to talk about that. Authorities estimate they did £1 million of damage. The damage done to law and order by just running away, though, is going to be incalculably worse. And we're seeing where Britain has brought in millions of migrants, many of whom, or some of whom at least, are hostile to their host country. And what we saw in Leeds last night is a direct result of that. And until we deal, you know, we're not doing anything to deal with the problem there, that is just going to get worse. So those are a couple of quick bits as well worth taking note of from Europe this week. We've heard from Jeremiah a little bit already, but I believe you have a rundown of news, of important news from Asia for us today.
Yes, first of all, Xi Jinping, the paramount leader of China, may have suffered a stroke this week during the Chinese Communist Party's third plenary session. This is not confirmed, but Chinese social media is abuzz with this story. Now, I used to think that if Xi Jinping were to die or be incapacitated, that there were 10 men, ideological clones of him, in the Chinese Communist Party who could step up and take his place, and that nothing big would really change with the party's leadership or any part of China's trajectory. But in recent years, Xi Jinping has really purged the Chinese Communist Party of everyone except for the most loyal sycophants, usually just men who are not really worth that much. These are just yes men who make him feel good about himself, but they have very little competence or the kind of integrity that you would need to lead. So the ones who could have led have mostly been purged, and these sycophants seem to be pretty much all that's left. This means that if Xi Jinping were to shuffle off the mortal coil, then China would likely have a real leadership crisis and be in some serious disarray. And the trumpet does expect China to somehow become less powerful than Russia in the near future and to actually be subjugated by Russia to a degree in the near future. So these reports of Xi Jinping's stroke may not prove accurate, or if they were, it may not have been terribly serious. But still, these kinds of stories are something that the trumpet will continue to keep a close eye on because of those prophecies about China becoming less powerful than Russia. Another story here about Russia, nuclear weapons, and the Old Testament law. A story that would be quite odd, I think, if it came from any nation besides Russia. But basically, the deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, he said Wednesday that because of the laws of the Bible, especially where it says an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, Russia is authorized to start a nuclear war against Ukraine and against the West. So this man is invoking the Old Testament here, Old Testament law, to say that Russia can burn the world up in nuclear Armageddon. But it did make me wonder if he's ever read the New Testament, which has a little bit of a different tone there, or if, for that matter, if he read a different part of the Mosaic law, Exodus 22:2, where it says, if a thief is caught breaking in at night and is struck a fatal blow, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. You know, the Russians did invade Ukraine at night under the cloak of darkness back in February of 2022. They broke in at night, so to speak. So it seems like Medvedev is being pretty selective here about which parts of Old Testament law he wants to apply. But in either case, we have to reset our counter back to zero. It has been 0 days since Russia threatened the world with nuclear annihilation. Seems like we never get past 5 or 6 days on that counter lately, and now we're back to zero.
And your main story today, I think, was thrown into pretty sharp relief with some dramatic news that we had this morning. I know this isn't exactly what you were planning on talking about, but I wanted to use it to shoehorn this story in there anyway, where I think we've kind of woken up this morning with a powerful reminder of how fragile so much of the modern systems that we rely on, where we've had this computer outage that's affected millions of people, where one company, CrowdStrike, the security company, they pushed out an update. I kind of feel a bit mad and also quite sympathetic to whichever individual at CrowdStrike did this, because it's completely the kind of thing I could see myself doing and probably have done, but because I'm not responsible for a company that does security for millions of computers, has never had this kind of impact, where they push out an update without it really being ready. And it's a driver update. It's an update that kind of loads before the operating system does and causes them all to crash. And the really bad thing about this is it pushes this update out once it's been installed. Because it's a driver level event and it prevents the system from loading, you can't fix it remotely. It crashes the system before the computer gets in a state where it's able to receive instructions over the network. And somebody has to physically go around and deal with the situation on that computer. And they've got to often come with a USB stick and deal with BitLocker encryption and all of these kind of things. And if you think about a company, a big company with thousands of computers, their IT staff is going to have a pretty horrible weekend. And it's going to take a long time before that company is fully up and running. And then you think about all of the computers that were never designed to be accessed physically, that are maybe handling like airport displays and some of these kind of things that were always designed to be remotely. And maybe you've got to get a lift to go get to them. This is not a situation that is going away particularly soon. And I've had people email in talking about our entire office is sitting around twiddling our thumbs this morning because all our work computers are down. I think the Federal Aviation Authority is talking about several US airlines. All their flights are grounded. There's several train systems are completely grounded because of this. There's people's banking. People aren't able to do any banking or transfer money for some. It's something that has affected millions and millions of people. Perhaps never in human history has so much inconvenience been caused for so many by so few. So it's not what your main story is another one, I think, related in that it's a story that really emphasizes how our daily lives are so reliant on some pretty high-tech technology that either by accident or maliciously could be kind of disrupted and destroyed at any time.
That's right, yes. And this story that I wanted to talk about, it is very much related to that massive outage from this morning. And it is that Russia is developing a space-based nuclear weapon that poses a serious threat to America's satellites and really to the entire modern way of life. That is according to a new assessment that was issued on Wednesday by U.S. General Stephen Whiting. He's the commander of U.S. Space Command. And he and his team are deeply concerned about the wide-ranging destructive potential of this new weapon, this nuclear weapon that Russia is currently developing and will soon place in orbit. I'll just read some of General Whiting's remarks here. This was at the Aspen Security Forum where he spoke about this, and he said, "It's a completely indiscriminate weapon. It would affect the US satellites, Chinese satellites, Russian satellites, European satellites, Indian satellites, Japanese satellites. And so it's really holding at risk the entire modern way of life. And it's just an incredibly reckless decision," end quote. So, you know, quite an alarming assessment there. And he's right. From what we understand of this new Russian weapon, it wouldn't be possible for the Russians to pinpoint just certain American satellites with it. And it would take out many of those of other nations, including Russia and China. Pretty much anything in the line of sight in low Earth orbit would be destroyed. So General Whiting seems to be trying to remind Russia of that. But the trouble is, the Russians are already well aware of that. And I don't think that that would necessarily deter them from using this new nuclear weapon. And that's because America is far more dependent on satellites than any other country. And America has much more to lose. The numbers are very telling here. There are around 7,100 active satellites up in orbit right now, 7,100. And of those, 4,700 are American. So America has more than twice as many as the rest of the world combined, 4,700. Russia, meanwhile, only has about 200 active satellites, and China maybe around 600. So it would be devastating to Russia and China to have some of those destroyed, but not nearly as devastating as it would be for the United States. So America and the American military are really uniquely vulnerable, asymmetrically vulnerable to satellite attacks. And since nations like Russia want to strike us where it hurts most, I think they very well may be willing to destroy some of their own space-based assets in order to destroy far more of ours. So it's a very worrying situation.
Absolutely. And I think there's so many components to modern life that just work that we kind of never talk about or think about until they stop. And I mean, more and more you're getting, thanks to Elon Musk, you've got internet infrastructure that's in space. We're using navigation to drive around that's in space. Much more importantly, you've got communication and, you know, TV and long-range communication. There's a lot just even in civilian life now that depends on space. But then the military angle as well, that there's, you know, I remember when I was looking at this years ago, it was talking about how the French army, after fighting with alongside the United States in Afghanistan, kind of deliberately went out of their way to unlearn reliance on satellite communication and on GPS and on all of these different space-based technologies and some other ones, because they feared that they were vulnerable and they saw just how integral they were to the US way of fighting. And they just basically took the view, we don't want to be dependent on that.
Yeah, I even remember reading about some European nations who had reversed course on even storing their files digitally and communicating with electronic communication. And they were going back to typewriters for official government communication. And I think a lot of times at the highest levels of government with some of these European nations, they're typing on a typewriter and physically handing that paper to another head of state or chief of staff or whatever it may be, just because they understand the vulnerabilities of electronic communication. But this is something that the Trumpet keeps a close eye on, because Bible prophecy talks about a time when America and some of its allies will be besieged by Russia and some of its allies. Isaiah 23, Ezekiel 27, also Deuteronomy, they all give some details about this. And then Isaiah 59 adds more really specific detail about this future time of calamity for the United States. In verses 9 and 10, the people of America are shown to be stripped of vision. It says, "We wait for light, but behold obscurity. We wait for brightness, but we walk in darkness. We grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes." It's already happening in a spiritual sense. In the United States, you can see, you know, in society and politics, that the nation is groping around in a condition of spiritual blindness. And the vision that is absent in this prophecy could also maybe include some physical kinds of vision, including that that is provided by America's thousands and thousands of satellites. These are our eyes in the skies, and they're very much at risk. So when you put these scriptures all together, it really makes Russia's new space-based nuclear weapon and everything that that could do to America's satellites even more concerning.
Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Well, Mihailo, we've still reserved a few minutes for you to enlighten us on the main stories from the Middle East.
Yes, I'll zip through these. There's been a lot of news from the Houthis, the terror group in Yemen. On Monday, they've claimed they hit the Olvia, a Cyprus-flagged ship in the Mediterranean, in conjunction with the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, an umbrella group that comprises the various Iranian proxies over there. It's still unconfirmed by media, at least, whether the Houthis were able to contribute to this attack or if it was just the Iraqi groups. But either way, the Houthis still were able to reach the Mediterranean. Actually, just this morning, in the wee hours in Tel Aviv, Israel, there was a drone attack from the Houthis that killed one person. And the Israeli Defense Forces were able to confirm that the drone was Iranian-made and that it was fired from Yemen. People that have listened to this program before would know we've talked about the Houthis for a while and how they were trying to aim towards the Mediterranean. For the longest time, we weren't sure if that was actually possible, if it was just bluster. The very threat itself, considering it's a jihadi group, is enough to send a few people quaking in their boots. But looks like we've got that confirmed, that they could reach the Mediterranean. They're probably going to be doing that more and more as time goes on. For a main story, though, speaking of Israel, I want to talk about the Israelis themselves and some strife going on at home. On Tuesday, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant announced that they will be finally drafting ultra-Orthodox Jews or Haredi Jews into the Israeli Defense Forces starting this Sunday with about 1,000 applications going out. The government has been dragging their feet on this for a long time with the 60,000 plus strong ultra-Orthodox community not wanting to have anything to do with enlisting. They've been exempt since the days of David Ben-Gurion. There were 400 back then. And the government's made up of ultra-Orthodox parties, of coalition partners. So it's obvious why Prime Minister Netanyahu has been dragging his feet on implementing this. In June, the Supreme Court ruled, no, there's no excuses anymore. You have to go ahead, and they're finally going to do it. How impactful this is going to be, we'll see. Gallant and the defense ministry has suggested that they might actually need to send out about 24,000 draft notices in the hopes that 3,000 of them will actually show up rather than just dodge the draft. But considering all the other instabilities going on in Israel, considering all the attacks Netanyahu is having from the left, if his own coalition partners, if a third of those supporters of those parties are trying to get away from the draft, they have no incentive to stay in the government. And this is bad news for Netanyahu, regardless of where you look at it.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Zekic. Well, that is about all that we have time for. We started this show by saying, well, if God just stepped into world events to protect and preserve President Donald Trump, what should you do about it? Well, I'll just point out some more resources we have to help answer that question. We have, of course, our website, thetrumpet.com. We have so many free pieces of literature that we're happy to send you that you can study on that website. I'd also point out our Key of David program going out this weekend. This is a 25-minute show by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry. This weekend, it is titled America Under Attack. I think it's the first or one of the first that have offered that booklet with the same title, America Under Attack. That's a really exciting show that was recorded before that assassination attempt, but really exposes the spiritual reality behind this week's news. I'd really encourage you to, if you enjoyed this show, go check that out. You can watch that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can get to that on YouTube. And also give a quick shout out to our sister website, pcg.church, where there's a lot of material there on what can you do and on how to live your life. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We say a big thank you as well to our engineering and production staff, Isaac Lorenz and George Haddad. We will be back next week, and until then, keep watching your world.